This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here again with Brandon Adamson, Constantine von Hoffmeister, and Ashley Messinger. We're going to be continuing where we left off, discussing the general scene known as left of the alt-right, alt-center, or alt-left. Great having you guys back on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks again.
Brandon, you were telling me that there are some things about the scene that we didn't go over that you'd like to elaborate on. Is there anything particularly on your mind?
Well, I think that, I mean, one thing that we didn't really get into too much is the how the scene has kind of evolved from what it was originally. I think that a few years ago, we were all kind of still more, I think, on the more or less on the fringes within the sphere of the alt-right. I think over time that, like, kind of a more genuine, like, alternative left kind of has started to emerge, and at the same time that, like, the alt-right has been kind of filled with, like, just so many crazy people, insane people. Since then, it seems to have changed.
Oh, are you talking about the implosion driving away a lot of the more the saner types?
Which
implosion? Well, yeah, just if you spend enough time in these communities, like you find that they're really there's really not a whole lot cohesive, and you find yourself thinking like, would I even want these people as neighbors? Now, like, in Europe, it's not quite the same thing because some of these, like, identitarian movements are more established and they're more cohesive, they're on the same page and they're in support of, like, ethnic nationalism. It's just a much, much saner scene. But when you see, like, in terms of the American, even if you look closer, like, the things that there is a consensus on, like, at least somewhat, are, you know, things that I don't necessarily agree with. But I think that you could see over the last few years that it's just become that people like us have been, even if we, like, wanted to be a part of it, we've essentially been pushed out or purged, just knowing that there's no way that, that we would be accepted. Like I said, there's... Yeah, a lot of my personal ties with the alt-right have already been, like, severed or pushed out.
And then on top of that, as we talked about in our last show, the whole election of Trump has caused friction between Robert Lindsay's faction of the alt-left and your kind of left-wing of the alt-right, which is more of a cultural niche group that kind of revolves around this site and your blog. And as I said, I'm on a personal level, I'm on friendly terms with Robert Lindsay, but there's been some fraction. So in a sense, we're kind of disconnected from both the alt-right and from what remains of the alt-left. But the thing is, there used to be this whole, for a while, there was this big alt-left scene on Facebook revolving around Ryan England. And now, like, a lot of those Facebook groups are, like, they're basically gone, and that whole scene is kind of evaporated.
Yeah, well, I think a big problem that caused a lot of confusion is when, like, Trump and these but Republicans started using the term alt-left to refer to, like, Antifa, and it caused a lot of confusion among people. But also, I think that the a big part of it is that the alt-right itself has just become, it's filled with so many insane people that they're just like, most people who have like, who are even open-minded and not necessarily that dogmatic, I think they feel like kind of pushed out, just looking for any kind of alternative, really.
Ashley and Constantine, you're both in Europe. Would you say there's an equivalent to this scene within European identitarian politics?
Well, my insight into the kind of things Brandon was talking about is kind of limited just because I'm a newcomer. I wasn't here even 2 years ago, but it does seem like in pretty much any community, once it gets above a certain size, a certain membership, there's an intrinsic kind of consensus-building tendency. So it feels as if it was sort of bound to happen, as annoying as it might have been. And that's the kind of thing Brandon was talking about. And I don't have... I mean, Britain is pretty out to lunch, to be honest. The identitarian movements in Europe are mostly in continental Europe. Like, I know that Generation Identitaire, or whatever, they do have a faction that's in Britain, but it doesn't... Well, I doubt that they're anywhere near as active here as they are on the continent. I think Constantine probably knows more about that.
Actually, I have a question. I have a question to Brandon, and to you as well. What kind of implosion are you referring to exactly? You said implying that the American alt-right somehow imploded, but I can't really see that. So maybe you could explain that really quickly. So
I can explain
what you
that.
Mean.
Well, I think that when the there were a few events that happened, but there were the first thing was that I can recall is really after Trump.
Oh, you mean the Hailgate?
Trump was around
there.
Hailgate, right. which I didn't think was a big deal at all. But
it was like I don't know, like over a year ago, and Charlottesville came afterwards, and.
Right. Well, yeah,
and
that's true,
that,
but it,
that continued. And
what
then,
happened
and then
is all these
the...
people got doxxed, and a lot of people decided it wasn't worth the risk, and then they went back to kind of, either they had their lives ruined, or they went back to kind of living a mainstream life, and they
kind of
dropped
right.
out.
Well, they kind
then
of
what
were
happened
like,
is
they
then,
decided...
then the really like kooky people like kind of took over.
Well, no, I wouldn't say just that, but you had people that were kind of... what it did is it amplified a lot of like internal feuds and rivalries. So, and one thing that I noticed is that whenever somebody gets like bad press or there's an incident or something, whoever like their personal enemies are in the movement, they will always pounce on that and actually use that to be like, see, this guy's making us look bad. And then there's all of these different factions, and you saw that with. Basically, I think what Robert was kind of alluding to is after Charlottesville, they had all of these people that really weren't really sure about like what the alt-right stood for or anything like that. A lot of those people kind of decided, well, we're just going to abandon this stuff and just like get back into Republican politics and just make it a little bit more nationalist.
Well, I think
and then
I
you
think
had the.
Yeah, I think a lot. I think the alt-right has pretty much disappeared. Like even Richard Spencer, like you don't hear anything from him anymore. I haven't heard from him in weeks or even months. You know, it's like he hasn't given any. He's not even on the news anymore. And the alt-right.com website is not being updated. It's basically a zombie site. It's been the same for the last, I don't know, 2 months with no new articles or anything. So yeah, I guess you're right because you don't.
Yeah,
hear.
And also
yeah,
let's
I,
not forget
I noticed
the other.
That as well.
Let's not forget the other incident with the Traditionalist Workers' Party. When they were completely destroyed, and that was a pretty large
activist
group.
But they weren't really alt-right, though. I don't think they considered themselves alt-right. Did they? Like, the Heimbach and his guys, like, did they consider themselves
I don't know if they used the label. They were kind of... They did show up at, like, the alt-right events, so they were all connected.
But which alt-right event? You mean Unite the Right?
Well, the ones where, like, Spencer's... I mean, they were in Charlottesville, and they were at Spencer's speech when he spoke in Michigan, right, when there was the big fighting.
The thing I view Matt Parrott and Matthew Heimbach as more of a continuation of the old school white nationalist scene that existed before the alt-right. So they're...
Well, too reactionary anyway.
They're very reactionary. They're way too reactionary. I want to get back to the question I was asking. So if you look at, like, European politics, you have Front National and Marine Le Pen, and she has a lot of progressive views on economics and environmentalism. And I was even reading some opinion polls that said her supporters are more socially liberal than supporters of the conservative candidate Fillon. So, Konstantin, would you say there is an equivalent of the scene that we're talking about in European identitarianism?
Yeah, you know, I think you have to differentiate between, say, the American alt-right and the European. Right, because the difference is that you have more like you have ethnic nationalism in Europe, and I think in America it's like more like racialism. So you have white nationalism in the U.S., where basically all these alt-right people that don't differentiate between like their different European heritages. So you can be like, I don't know, German American, French American, Spanish American, whatever. But the main focus is on being white, first of all, like white American, European American, but in Europe it's completely different. Like you, Robert, you were with me when we were at that the Young National Democrat meeting, the youth wing of the NPD this year, and they try to gather all these European nationalist groups from several different countries, and the whole idea of the conference was to show unity and solidarity between European nations and forget about the old squabbles and let's just work together and let's not be enemies anymore, let's bury the hatchet, so to speak. Well, it's a good idea, sounds nice, but of course they couldn't really do it, because even at this conference you had like the Ukrainians bitching about the Russians, and you had the Russian guy bitching about the Ukrainians, you had the Croats complain about the Serbs about the Croats, the Greeks about the Macedonians, etc. So basically they weren't even capable of doing this, of following the rule that the conference set forth, basically. And I think that in America, it's more progressive. I think in America, they're one step ahead because they think beyond nations. In America, it's purely racially focused because this is the only kind of identity that Americans have, because it's not really like a real nation with a real tradition per se. So basically, like, people identify along tribal lines, which means racial lines. But in Europe, it's different because you still have these, I don't know, ancient or even old nations. So people are more nationalist. So you have like an NPD guy from Germany who still feels resentment towards the Poles for stealing German territory after World War II, and to the Czechs for the same, etc., and so on. And they just can't forget about it. They can't think in a pan-European term. And I think this is why America is more progressive, because they think in racial terms, in white terms, which is automatically pan-European.
Yeah, I have kind of mixed feelings about that, because on one hand, Americans don't have those strong divisions, but on the other hand, you get all these German Americans in the Midwest who have no strong cultural connection to German culture. They're just kind of generic, like suburban people, and if you do have like a tiny like Bavarian themed town in America, it's more like kind of a tourist trap. Like I think they have one in Texas,
But that's my whole point.
Yeah, they have, Solvang, up where I live, which is Danish, and we have these places, so we don't have the tension of Europe, but people kind of lack that kind of cultural connection, and then there's a lot of people like me and probably Brandon who are of a mixed ancestry, so there's pros and cons to that. There isn't the division, but Americans lack this strong cultural connection, unless it's a very kind of strong regional identity. So New England has a regional identity connected to the British. There's some regional identity in the South. As I said, with the Germans, I think Italian-Americans and Irish-Americans still have some degree of identity, but even though, like, German-Americans are large numerically, they've, like, went way out of their way to assimilate.
How many Italian-Americans actually speak Italian? I don't think that many.
Well,
I definitely don't.
Yeah, but that's my point, though. Like, how many German-Americans actually speak German, or, I don't know, in Louisiana, the Cajuns, how many still speak French? Like, hardly any. My point is that the culture was basically lost in America, because I think these tribal cultures, even in the beginning, say 18th century, 19th century, were still very strong, because the Germans, German Americans, say in the 19th century, they still published their own German newspapers, had their own German books, German schools, German kindergartens, etc. And all that's lost now, basically, they've been submerged in this American mass of, I don't know, consumers.
Right, and the Italians for a long time.
Europe is just a couple of decades behind, because in Europe you will see the same, because in Europe you have more and more foreigners, and people also losing touch with their roots, losing touch with their culture, because it doesn't mean anything anymore to be German or French nowadays. And if only, like, say 50% or less than 50% of people in Germany are actually ethnically German, what does it mean to be German? It means nothing, basically. They will also lose their culture, and then they will also think, I believe, more along racial lines, and I would say, like, a white German will feel more in common, say, with a white French guy than with some, I don't know, Senegalese German.
Right, and I would just, like, that's a good point, and I agree, and I think that's kind of what really gets at it, is that I forget what a European writer or something, he said that he never felt like he was white until he went to South Africa. And I think that, like, once the demographics get to a certain level, it's almost like you end up just having to identify as white. I mean, if you were, like, in an American prison, you might never have the thought of yourself as white until you're actually in prison, and you only make up 10 or 15% of the prison population, and you've got to, you're going to notice things that you maybe didn't before. So if in a lot of these European countries, the demographics are not really the same as an issue as in certain cities in the United States. So,
well, not yet, but
they will be. Right.
But it's already there, because now, like, in Britain, London is minority white. Now Birmingham is officially minority white. You have several cities in Germany now that are minority German and majority non-German. Well, it's happening very fast. Like, it's only a matter of, like, one or two more decades, basically, or maybe three, and that's it. So, and you'll be in the same situation in Europe as you are now in America.
Yeah, the situation, I totally agree. Constantine, can you kind of get back to that question, like, is there kind of an equivalent of the scene that we're doing in Europe, or is this a uniquely American phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it's a uniquely American phenomenon for the reasons I specified earlier. But I mean, you have generation identity, and you have collaboration.
But I'm not necessarily talking about the alt-right. I'm talking about this specific scene, which you could call, like, the left of the alt-right or the alt-center that me and Brandon and Ashley are affiliated with.
Okay, on the last show we discussed this topic. It depends exactly what you mean by, say, the left version of the alt-right. Do you mean, like, purely economically or also culturally? Because, like, economically you definitely have it, because, like, the NPD in Germany, for example, is almost like a socialist party. Well, sort of like national socialist, but still socialist, like, strongly outspoken anti-capitalists, etc. So I'd say it's definitely left-wing in an economic sense. But culturally, I think no, because they're still very conservative, like, when it comes about, like, quote-unquote degeneracy and so on, like we talked about last time. So, and I think it's, the Front National is the same. You mentioned a lot of the members of, like, the Front National and Le Pen's party in France. They're socially liberal, but I don't think it's the official platform of the party, though, as far as I know. Like, they don't... I'm not sure. I don't think they promote gay rights and all that stuff openly.
Well, let's just take... Yeah, I totally agree about economics. There's this, like, large strain of social nationalism that is economically populist nationalism with some social conservative and traditional leanings. Since we were talking a lot about art and architecture on our last show, and the show we did about Europe, about how European nationalists will freak out, like they'll freak out if they see like a skyscraper in their city. Have you met any European nationalists or identitarians in person or on Facebook who appreciate, say, modern art or architecture?
Never.
Not a single one?
I just remember I was at the London Forum, like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and I was driving around with all these, I don't know, British nationalists in a car through London, and all they were doing is, like, pointing out, like, modern buildings. Oh, look at that hideous monster! Look at this piece of shit! Oh, my God, they ruined this once beautiful classical city! I was like, I kind of like these buildings, you know? I don't know.
Some of my favorite, like, post-war buildings... in London are Centre Point, which is a kind of a more modern version of brutalism, the BT Tower, which is like this futuristic radio tower from the 60s. I like the Lloyd's Building from the 80s by Richard Rogers, even the cool kind of cyberpunk buildings. So, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff is fantastic. Ashley, you're in England, do you agree?
Yeah, the only person I can think of right now is this. Gert Wilders in the Netherlands, who's sort of like anti-immigration and is strongly anti-Muslim, etc., but he's very strongly pro-gay and extremely liberal, but also economically liberal and, say, not socialist at all. So, it's difficult to find an equivalent of, say, the alt-left in Europe. I can't really find it.
What about Jörg Haider, who dead, but he was in Jörg Haider in Austria. He was a nationalist, he was economically populist, but he was also a homosexual. What about him?
Well, I don't know. What about him? Yeah, but he wasn't openly homosexual, though. That's the point.
Constantine, that's an important, I think, distinction to make, is you do have some of these, like homosexuals in the alt-right, but they're still like anti-homosexual. It's almost like they might actually be, but they're still like, they're not really like pro-gay or anything like that. They're still like, they're kind of like, yeah, it's an affliction that we have to accept or something like that. What I mean? That's kind
of... The only part, do you remember a couple of years ago, it was this English guy, Alistair Clark. He had a website called Aryan Futurism, and he died, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. But I talked to him several times on the phone, and I wanted to visit him, but never made it. But he was openly homosexual, and he also promoted homosexuality, like in the terms of Männerbund, you know, those like fraternities and the warrior ethos, Sparta, etc. So.
I remember he made a lot of people like very butthurt. You know?
No
pun intended. But like,
his website is still accessible, Aryan Futurism. You can read his essays; they're quite good, actually.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a demographic because I just check my hit counts, and I get plenty of hit counts from Europe. So I'm sure there's people in Europe who share those views. They're just not really organized. Have any of you guys read that article on Alt of Center titled Homo Nationalism?
Yes, I read it.
What did you think?
I read, yeah.
Any reactions?
Well, no, I mean, I just like, I don't really care about one way or the other. So I don't really pay too much attention to the issue other than like, I personally try to avoid people that I think are just too like prudish or sexual puritan because like, you know, it's just not the kind of like people I surround myself with normally. Like I went to like Arlington, Texas one time for a guitar show, a convention or something. And I was just like, it was like the most like miserable place I've ever been to. Like it was just kind of, they had like the television in my hotel room, it had like four like Christian channels, and they had like a show that was like a about partial birth abortion. It was called like Almost Born, and it was like a, you know, something. It was kind of I was just like, I was there for, and you couldn't buy alcohol there. It was like you had to drive outside the county, or if you wanted to order a drink at a restaurant, like you had to do some workaround where you like join their supper club so you can order a drink or something. It was just kind of like, I just couldn't wait to get the fuck out of there. So it's like,
yeah, but,
that's kind of, you know.
But it's demographic. It's a democracy. It's democratic because it's a tri-county and the people voted for it. So you just have to accept the people's will here.
Well, I do accept it. It's just kind of like, if I'm in a political movement, then I have to make a recognition that, like, okay, well, these aren't actually people that I would want to live around. So I need to recalibrate, like, who I'm associating with politically, if it's to such and such ends.
Yeah, I totally get that. But the thing is, like, we're a very fairly small group, but I am getting a lot of positive responses. I think we're growing. I do want to, like, kind of get back to the topic of art. And in our last show, we were talking about art and what is degeneracy.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm a big fan of modern architecture from, say, Art Deco to Brutalism to 70s and 80s retrofuturism. I even like some of the newer skyscrapers. And I like a lot of modern art, including, like, Mondrian, who Brandon's also a fan of. And
yeah,
just a lot of...
Well, I hate Mondrian.
Okay.
I just think it's ugly, that's all. Like, I can't even explain it. I just find them hideous, those elongated figures or faces.
And I, yeah.
That's kind of funny because, like, I have a lot of paintings, actually. I'm an abstract painter, and I actually have some paintings which were similar to Mondrian, like kind of in that style.
Oh yeah,
inspired by those. Those were my like my biggest selling paintings. Like I just sold those like nothing. Like I've sold almost all of my paintings. I don't even have any left. I sold like maybe 30 or 40 of them, but I just think like. That's another thing, too, is that you have all of these people, these right-wing people, like, they just hate modern art and all of this stuff. So it's like, when I see that, like, it's like, I check out, you know, because that's, like, the stuff that I prefer, not these, like, Renaissance paintings and, like, these, like, landscapes. Nothing against those. I don't see anything wrong with them. It's just not it's not something that I'm into.
I can appreciate, like, the French Rococo if it's, like, erotica.
Well, I recognize that it's, like, that a lot of it is good and it's awesome, but doesn't mean that, like, I think that that's a big mistake that a lot of right-wing critics of art make, is that they just assume that, like, people that are into modern art or abstract art, like, they don't care about beauty, but it completely neglects the fact that a lot of abstract art is decorative, and people buy it to decorate their homes, not to make some kind of incomprehensible, abstract, ugly statement or something like that. A lot of it is purely decorative, so obviously, like, people, like, it's not, they just automatically assume that they take it for granted that it's just ugly.
And you know? Brandon, you've obviously seen my work. I've had people say that even my artwork is too degenerate and too modern. What is your basic take on that, and how would you describe my aesthetic?
Well, I mean, you definitely have your own style. I think it's kind of it's somewhere in between. Like, it's not entirely representational, but it's kind of in between, where it's kind of your it's almost like a cityscape painting or a landscape painting or something, but seen like through your unique eyes, not like a photographic reproduction, you know. Just it's more like seen through the colors and things that you want to emphasize.
Yeah, I have my own unique style. Some people have made comparisons to Fauvism.
Gauguin in it, and Paul Gauguin, and I think it's naive, but in a good way. Sort of like, you know, Gauguin, like so this style, like Brandon's, not photorealistic, but still representational, but a unique vision, a naive vision, an innocent vision.
And there's that's definitely true. And with my work, there's definitely a theme of retrofuturism. If you can pick up on that,
I can.
Yeah, well, there's also I think Constantine picks up on the innocence. There's almost like a childlike quality to it, which is kind of the way that people like you or people like me, when we get to a city, like almost this childlike excitement of seeing sights that most people just would not get that excited about or even notice.
Yeah, like I think that really comes across. Just go to Las Vegas to gamble and get drunk. And we kind of go there and like envision just as this kind of a retro-futurist fantasy world. And most people,
I stayed in Las Vegas for two weeks a couple of years ago and didn't gamble once.
Well, you know, I meant to make a video about this, but I like when I go to Las Vegas, I don't like I'm like a like an old lady. I play like vintage like 80s and 90s slot machines. Like I don't have like. And I don't even really care about it. It's just the aesthetic of those old machines with the noises and the cymbals.
Oh, remember
I, like, the, I don't play table games.
Remember the one you put up on Frog Twitter?
Oh yeah, when there was I found that like frog themed slot machine that looked like almost looked a little bit like Pepe, and that was I didn't actually play that though. It was,
you should post a picture somewhere.
I will. I'll send you one, Robert. You can use it for something.
But what I wanted to kind of get at is I do think that traditionalist and alt writers, they, even though I disagree with their aesthetic visions, they do have a point when they say that a lot of the cultural left kind of celebrates ugliness. I mean, the most extreme examples would be like these feminist artists who do these weird things with like their menstrual blood. But I think that is an accurate critique of the left. Do you think they have a point about that?
Well, I think so, but I think that like these critics always like they can't differentiate between any styles of art really. It's like everything is to them is just modern art. You know what I mean? It's like everything like they don't distinguish between like, you know, postmodern or someone who is just like taking a shit in the bucket is not necessarily the same thing as just an ordinary old non-representational
think Piss Christ is like the same as Mondrian. They have no like nuance,
right? Or like Rothko is the same as as Piss Christ, right?
So that's kind of the thing, is a lot of these alt writers, they fantasize about creating this this ethno state in the Pacific Northwest, and let's just say hypothetically they got their way and they were able to pull it off. Like, what if they just create this like really boring conservative community of like suburban homes, and there's no like innovation as far as like architecture goes. So instead of they get their dream of like their own country, but you don't see any cool like retro futuristic cities or kind of like arcologies, but just this kind of same like these like boring suburbs you find in Texas. Like, that's kind of a far off like dream, but even if they get their way, like I think that's very likely.
Yeah, I do. I think it's extremely likely, actually, and that is, I think, if you remember Decay, you know, that guy who used to be around, he always said that that was, like, one of his biggest fears, is that they would do all this work and get the ethno-state, and that it would be, like, a place that banned, like, dance music and all this stuff, and rock and roll, it'd be a place that he wouldn't even want to live. And that was kind of a point that I made in an article I did, like, maybe, I think it was maybe about a year ago or so, two articles, actually, that The Outer Limits of an Ideological Future and Skirting the Issue with Tara McCarthy, which is basically that if the alt-right continued in this direction, that there was going to be a large segment of people that was maybe sympathetic to their views, but if you spend enough time in these alt-right communities, like, a lot of people ultimately conclude that, like, well, hey, maybe diversity and multiculturalism isn't that bad, actually. You know, it's kind of like you go into those communities and you come out with the idea that, well, maybe diversity isn't so bad after all. I mean, if you spend enough time with some of these people, I think that's totally likely.
I think what I would, if hypothetically, if I were like rich, and hypothetically they pull off their own country, I would like kind of do the whole like Jewish thing where I would get dual citizenship and have like a cool mid-century modern home in like California or the Bay Area. And then I'd travel to the ethno state every now and then, like an Israeli well, with dual citizenship.
They may not be that tolerant of that, though, in the ethno state, or of anything really. Like,
and they might not allow my future.
Part of me, to be
they
honest.
Might not allow my future blonde wife in either.
But yeah, I don't know. I came to that.
Part of me actually kind of hopes that.
Yeah, I came to that kind of realization like maybe a year or a year and a half ago that it was just like, gosh, if these people are just so miserable to interact with and I wouldn't want to live around them, maybe somebody, we just have to like, you know, try to figure something else out.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have that. If somebody as like that's been involved in these communities and like, you know, written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles, if someone like that's been committed to some of these ideas for many years, if even I'm like, oh, well, God, these people suck, like, you know, then I imagine what someone who's just kind of like, just kind of feels some level of agreement or attachment with it, like they're just, you know, they're not going to get on board.
Well, it's like those Nazi villages you have in East Germany that you sometimes read about, small towns,
yeah.
Like Thuringia, etc., with the small villages where the NPD gets like 30%, 40%, or 60% even. Yeah, I don't know, like, what I read about them, and watching interviews with the people that live there, it doesn't seem like
yeah,
a really
yeah.
pleasant and fun place, you know? Like, all they do is, like, they celebrate these bizarre, silly pagan rituals, like summer solstice with bonfires and
right, it's like the Wicker Man.
Third
the Wicker Man.
Write songs to the children, etc.
I'd almost rather like live in
a. And get tattoos.
I'd almost rather live around like the nudist in Munich than one of those places if I were German.
Oh yeah, I agree with you.
So Brandon, so, you have this. You've kind of have this interest in creating these self-contained cities, kind of on the Logan's Run aesthetic. And you talk about building them in these, like, remote islands. That sounds kind of isolated, but can you elaborate on that idea more?
Well, I think that, that at least, like I said, this in Europe, it's a different situation. These European countries is a different situation. But I think that, like, people that are wealthy, at least if I was wealthy, what I would do is I would try to, you know, maybe buy up some of these unclaimed islands or like abandoned communities and try to form some kind of autonomous city state, you know, that has some basis that would be kind of technical, almost like Vapor Island. You know, I like to look on maps and I look at these islands that are off the state of Washington, Oregon, and if you were to purchase one of these and develop it to some kind of a city state, a technologically advanced city state, I think that is like a potential way forward. And you wouldn't really need to make it explicitly like racial or anything like that. You could just by its own nature, by developing it, it would attract a certain kind of people. You know, kind of like, you know, if you would go to like Catalina Island or one of these places, it's not like billions of migrants washing up on the shores.
Actually,
or something. It has
never,
its own inherent like.
Yeah, I've never been to Catalina Island, but I've heard they actually have a big problem with illegal immigration because they need like the cheap labor to work at all those resorts.
Well, that's just the same old, like, conservative...
Exactly, right.
...problem, like, of these rich people that, like, they end up eating themselves because they hire these cheap pets and, like, quasi-servants and slaves, and then eventually those people decide that they become numerous enough that they want a piece of the action, you know, and that's the same old problem that you see everywhere. But I think that you can create that kind of island or city-state or something like that, and if it is done right, it will just inherently attract a certain kind of people that are interested in the things that you're interested in. I think that's really what, you know, what my dream is. Is like you have like we talked about on another show how I found like the like a large airport was kind of almost a blueprint for like a self-contained city, or a city or island state just had all of the components to it. But like I said, that's if I was a billionaire or a trillionaire, that's what I would be doing. But maybe if I had that much money, I just like wouldn't give a shit about anything, and I would just like use the money to buy hookers and stuff because I just had it made.
So,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, I support freedom of association, but even under the kind of current structure, you're just kind of, it doesn't have to be, as you said, explicitly along ethnic lines. You sort of base a community around common values, and you attract people with similar interests. So maybe it's going to be like 80% European, but you might have like a handful of Asians who have a similar interest, or one black person, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be like 100% European.
Right. That's my point. It's like you, when you have something like, even if you take a look at transhumanism, like at these like transhumanist conferences and what, they don't say like, you know, no black people allowed, or no Mexicans or anything like that. It's just that like there's only certain kinds of people that are even going to show up. And if you have, it's just like Dungeons and Dragons or something. If you have like a black guy that's actually taken an interest in it, you know, more power to him. You know, there's like I once said that there is like if there is anything like that, like a black person that would be like an honorary Aryan, it would be like a black dude that gets into like Dungeons and Dragons role playing. I mean, to think like how you would have to the hoops you'd have to go through culturally to even get to that, like, you know, who cares? Like,
I kind of like that idea of honorary Aryanism, because it's saying like not everyone has to be of the same race. I mean, obviously a homogenous society is more sustainable, but you do need to have people in your country who share your same cultural and political visions. You can't have like people who are actively hostile, whether it's hostile politically or hostile as far as like hostile cultural or aesthetic interests. So you do need that cohesion, but it's okay if you have, as John Derbyshire said,
you have some outliers.
Yeah, he uses the analogy as like a little bit of spice. It's okay if you have a few of these like people who are of different backgrounds, but they share the same common values. And I mean, that's kind of the concept in the Old of Center article, if you've read it, called Neon Nationalism, where you base a society of nationalism based on aesthetics rather than just purely race or nationality. I mean, I think that's a really fascinating idea. And I'd even like I would even support building these kind of communities that are sort of self-contained. You separate like a portion of a city or a suburbs, and you build a self-contained community that would have like a school, a shopping area, parks, recreations, gardens. And I would actually like to see that in major urban areas like LA and the San Francisco Bay Area, but that would be a lot more difficult to do due to both the real estate cost and political opposition. But I think people need to get a lot more creative about thinking about new ideas.
Well, kind of riffing on what Brandon was saying, as far as creative new ideas, I think another possibility, even if it's a little LARPy would be, you could have something like autonomous buildings when the technology becomes available to make that like a sustainable thing. Arcology is basically like the Crystal Island type thing that's being proposed in Moscow, or you know, the Shimizu pyramid that's being proposed in Tokyo, that kind of thing. These well, you know what an arcology is, right?
Oh,
these,
yes, I did. If you
man-made structures that could house, yeah.
Yeah, there was that one. Pablo Soleri had the plan for the massive one in Arizona, Arcosanti.
Arcosanti, yeah.
And there's a smaller one being built near Prescott, Arizona. Then I recently interviewed Richard Register about that. And that's a good example. I mean, Richard Register, who I interviewed, and Brandon, you saw that. I mean, I'm pretty sure he came out of the kind of 60s left counterculture for the environmental movement. So, I mean, the reality is a lot of the people who have the most innovative ideas about architecture and urban design are of the left. And if you read a lot of these urbanist blogs, a lot of people have these great urbanist ideas, and they're very, but they're at the same time they're very liberal, and right-wing people from like mainstream conservatives to paleo conservatives to the alt-right, they just don't. I mean, there's a few exceptions. So like one exception to that is a YouTuber, Black Pigeon Speaks. He's kind of alt-right or maybe semi-alt-right, but he has a strong passion in urbanism. But those kind of people, I mean, they're great, but they're kind of the outliners.
Well, he's also like a hardcore traditionalist. I think that, and he's like an urbanist in the sense of,
he did a show praising urbanism in Tokyo, and I think of Tokyo as being one of the most futuristic places on Earth.
Right, but a lot of the like the urbanism that people like him talk about is more of like reclaiming the cities, that kind of thing. Not so much of the kind of like exotic, 1960s and 70s like science fiction influenced ideas that these people have. But I think that that's, you bring up a good point though, that these a lot of these people into this into new urbanism and building these exotic condos and things like that, they're all almost always far left. They love diversity in that, but it's this contradiction because like the kind of buildings they make like only appeal to these like yuppie whites and maybe Asians and Indians. Like they're not like the kind of they support mass immigration, but like the kind of people that are even would be remotely interested in the stuff they do, it's all implicitly white, basically.
Constantine, do you want to comment on that topic?
Well, just what Brandon was saying just now, but it's that kind of behavior you see everywhere. It's like, I think we were talking about this before, like people say they support mass immigration, they say it's wonderful to have all the Mexicans and Turks, Arabs, etc. in the country, but at the same time they themselves don't want to live in a diverse neighborhood. They do everything possible to live in a middle-class white neighborhood. And if they happen to live in a diverse neighborhood, they try to save enough money to send their kids to, say, a Catholic private school because it is more white than, say, a public school because it is safer automatically. So
yeah.
They say they support multiculturalism, but the actions speak a completely different language. And you see this in the United States, but you see the same in Europe, like in Germany, for example, like people, what people say and what people actually do. So it's a sort of like a, I would say, collective schizophrenia almost.
I think one of the reasons that conservatives and right-wingers are so hostile to urbanism and mass transit is because they have this sort of, they implicitly associate urbanism with diversity, but they're not going to flat out say that. So they say the suburbs are the solution. But here's the thing is, like, now the suburbs are transforming demographically, so that's no longer an excuse.
Yeah, and what I've never understood is this obsession with like going back to nature and living in a village or growing your own vegetables and living on a farm. You know, it's like you have this obsession like a lot on the right. You know, so the
organic, like going to the bathroom in an outhouse. Like,
what the hell is this? I don't want to live on a farm. I don't want to live in a village. It's boring as hell. Like, I want to live in a city. I like the city, the dynamism of a city, like the energy that you have in a city. So I don't want to live in some boring forest. You know, like what I'm going to do? Milk cows and walk around.
Well,
I don't understand.
I like having both. I like being able to live in a city, but maybe...
And you can have mega cities like megalopolis, like Tokyo, with like over 30 million people, which is completely racially and ethnically homogenous. And it's the same with Seoul in Korea, etc. You can go to like Mumbai or New Delhi. These are all massive cities. And very interesting cities, both from an architectural point of view, from in terms of infrastructure, etc., but also like traditional, to some extent, culturally and ethnically homogeneous, so it's possible. So you don't need to go back to grow your own potatoes just if you want to stay in a homogeneous society. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, I kind of.
You can also have cities that. That incorporate green spaces and stuff like, and parks like Tokyo and Singapore, which is something that I really like.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting at. I kind of like mixing, having access to both. I think if you just analyze the most places that have the most desirable real estate, and I wrote about this topic in my article. I'll post a link titled Retrofitting Aesthetically Pleasing Suburbs. The ideal is to have access to both urbanism and to nature. I mean, one example I'll give you is in my last trip to the San Francisco Bay Area, I got up in the morning and I drove up to the mountains. It was a place called Mount Diablo, and I felt like I was in this remote location. And then I drove out to the city center in San Francisco, and I felt like I was in New York City. So just that intensity of having access to nature and the city in the same day is really remarkable. And even L.A., I mean, L.A. is a disaster with all the suburban sprawl, but you can still, like, take a day trip up to the San Gabriel Mountains, or there's even places like the San Bernardino Mountains, Big Bear and Lake Arrowhead, and...
Well, even in the hills, like, there's an element of you're not completely...
Santa Monica Mountains, so, yeah... And also, like, as what Ashley was getting at, having, like, these really great urban parks and gardens. And, yeah, that's one thing I do like about London when I visited, is they have all these amazing parks. Like, L.A. is just such a disaster because, I mean, it's not all bad because we have, like, the Santa Monica Mountains. But I'm just thinking about all these golf courses in L.A., and they could be transformed into these really amazing, like, parks, similar to what they have in London with, like, Holland Park. I wanted to ask Constantine this. So, Constantine, you're in Russia. Russia, on one hand, is a country that it's fairly nationalistic compared to the United States and Western Europe, but they do have all these great futuristic aesthetics from like that place Crystal Island, and then there's this street, I forget the name, but it has
Novi Arbat.
Oh, Novi Arbat. They have all this.
It's in New Arbat Street, yes.
All this cool neon. So, would you say in Russia is there a conflict, or do Russians view it as compatible to be both a nationalist and a futurist?
You know, I think they view it as compatible because, like, just in terms of architecture, walking around Moscow, you notice that they build a lot of, like, say, modern-looking skyscrapers, like steel, glass, etc. But at the same time, they build a lot of, say, apartment buildings in, like, say, like early 20th century Art Deco or even Art Nouveau style, sort of like a neo Art Deco style or neo Art Nouveau style or even the 19th century style. Or classical style, so you see that a lot too. It's very popular now. So in that sense, it's sort of like archaeo-futurist, because they do take a lot of, like, say, architectural styles from the past, but at the same time, they also innovate with very progressive designs, like Moscow City, the business district, where it's completely futurist, like nothing classical about it, but surrounded on the other side, you're surrounded by these like sort of like old-fashioned buildings. So you do have this contrast there, which I myself find quite interesting, because it makes it more eclectic and therefore more interesting to look at.
Would you say that Russian nationalists are more progressive than Western European nationalists, or they have the same problems?
Yeah, I think they have the same problems. You know, so they, in general, like most nationalists, they're very narrow-minded. They hate the Ukrainians now, and I don't know, maybe the Chechens and maybe the Georgians. It depends, like, you know, who's at war at the moment with whom, etc. Yeah, so they do have these like chauvinist hang-ups, just like all nationalists basically, and that's why basically I'm opposed to nationalism for this precise reason.
Right, and I also have noticed that a lot of Russians are like, they're very kind of cocky, and they're like arrogant in the sense that it's like, well, you know, we don't mind mass immigration in Russia because, like, we Russians are tough and we just, like, put them in their place, you know, something like that. It's kind of like they have, like, a lot of them have this mentality of, like, well, you know, we're not bothered by any of these migrants. We can take them in because we're Russians. Like, we have balls. We'll keep them in their place.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not a Russian nationalist would never say that, though. Like I've never met a Russian nationalist who would say something like this, because they're all against, like, this mass immigration of non-Russians.
Yeah, you're talking
but
about
have, like,
the kind of...
Like the Eurasianists, they would say something like this, like, okay, like, we can integrate them, you know, like the people from Central Asia, because we're this imperial nation, we're not just, like, a small nation, we're an empire, and empire always... consists of, like, different ethnicity, different nationalities, and we can integrate them, and as long as they follow the imperial idea, the imperial vision, etc., something like Alexander Dugin would say. Yes. So, yeah, and you do have mass immigration, because, like, I read recently an article that, like, after the United States, like, Russia is has a second highest rate of immigration in the world.
Russia is like such a huge landmass that it seems like they're, it's not, the issues with it aren't going to be completely apparent because it's so large.
It's a huge landmass, but most of it is completely uninhabited because all the immigrants come to these cities. It's like
right.
I mean, 90% of Russians live on the western side of the Ural Mountains, but the bigger part is on the eastern side. There's almost nobody lives there.
I get the same thing in the United States. I hear pro-immigration advocates on the liberal side and capitalist side saying, "Oh, immigration's fine because we have all this empty space."
Yeah, but
they're going to
move.
But they all move to California, and that's the problem. California is totally overrun with third world immigration. So.
They also talk about the all that open space, that, like, we need to preserve nature and all this, but at the same time they're like, well, we have all of this open space, but we can bring in millions and millions of people, even though we're, like, having to import natural resources like from like countries that are openly hostile to us. Like, we buy oil from countries that that we're supposedly, you know, quasi enemies with, and you think that, like, if we didn't have enough resources to be autonomous with the people that we've already got, like, why would we take in millions of more people if we already have to, like, import all of these natural resources from countries which openly hate us? Like,
this is slightly off topic, but Constantine, what are your thoughts on Russia's recent decision to let in South African Boer farmers?
Well, it's a very good decision. I support it because now I think the agricultural sector in Russia is booming, and I believe, like, the Boer farmers already promised to invest, like, certain sums of money in the agricultural sector, so Russia will benefit and the Boer farmers will benefit. So basically everybody benefits. So it's very good. It's excellent. I just think it's shameful that no other Western country, like, either in Western Europe, United States, has made a similar offer.
Yeah, I mean, not even Trump will do this. I think that as far as South Africa goes, it's a lost cause. There's no point trying to salvage that country. But we should just say, like, they should have, like, the right of return to either Europe or United States in the same way that Israel does.
Definitely.
And that would just be such a tremendous boost to whatever country, whether it's Russia, United States, or Europe.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because the South Africans that, like, that I've met that have actually come here, like, they're some of, like, the most, like, cucked people. Like, you would think that they would be, like, the most kind of aware or something like that, but there are, like, who's that actress, like, Charlize Theron? Isn't she from South Africa?
Yeah, she is.
Got, like,
well, I think you have a point, because the other day I was at the beach, and I saw some white South Africans in a Jeep, and I noticed that they had the ANC flag rather than the Afrikaner or the old South African flag. So I think you're right. But those people who come here were kind of like the liberal elites who were able to, like, get all their money and escape. They don't represent, like, the average South African white.
Yeah, you might be right. I think a lot of, like, a lot of these like nationalists that kind of fetishize, like, bringing in these people, I think that they're, like, they have the idea that these are, like, these, they're all these, like, people that are on board with them, and these, like, racially aware people. Which, in my experience in meeting these people, it's been, like, the complete opposite. Like, they're, like, I don't know. That's just my experience. But I think that, like, just assuming that, you know, they basically think that they're bringing in all of these, like, white nationalists or something
but
like that.
I don't care as much about the politics. I'm more interested in having the kind of people who will create a better society. So say you have, like, these kind of upper middle class kind of swipple types, and they decide to have, like, 3 to 4 kids. I mean, even if their politics are liberal, if they're going to kind of benefit...
Yeah, they're going to be, like, productive members of society.
Yeah, if they're going to be productive members of society and create the kind of place I want to live in, I think politics is secondary to that.
Yeah, that could be. But if you look at it, it's almost kind of like when the argument is often made that, like, people bring in immigrants that actually vote against the policies of those that advocate bringing them in. I think it's like people always assume that's only the case with, like, Mexicans or Africans or these other groups, but it's all, like, these laborers and things. But I think it's also probably just as much the case with these South Africans. But, like, I wouldn't say that we shouldn't take them or anything like that. I don't get excited about it or put them on this, like, pedestal. The same way that, like, a lot of people that in the alt-right would, like, that they're just kind of, like, almost, like, have, like, a fanatical appreciation for these people. I'm just like, well, you know, I've met some of them that come over here, and they're really not, you know, they probably would hate you, you know, if they were here. So.
Yeah, that's a reasonable thing to say, but as I was saying, I care more about the kind of society of people would create than their political ideology. So one example is a place like Vermont or a place like Boulder, Colorado. I'm not going to agree with those people politically, but they create places like Vermont. They create a kind of society that is the kind of place you'd want to live. That, like, they create a high quality of life. And the same could be said about a lot of the liberal, homogenous parts of, like, Germany and Scandinavia. I may not agree with those people politically, but if they're creating a high standard of living, that's an important thing. And obviously there's going to be a lot of those people are going to vote in, like, pro-immigration politicians, so there's problems. But I care more about the kind of the culture and the society that people create rather than the politicians.
Well, for now, but until Vermont starts bringing in all of these people, like that woman who just won in New York, I can't remember what her name is, but, like, the people that are just, like, that want to combine Vermont's policies with total open borders, which is makes absolutely no sense to anyone who with any kind of logic. But I think that that may indeed be the future of some of those areas if they continue. They're going to bring those people in if they're going to end up eating their own societies that they've created. Like which, like you say, they're creating these societies that I would want to live in. But at the same time, if they're going to vote for policies that are they're going to end up eating their own societies, that it's going to be like it's going to be a wash. You know, San Francisco is actually becoming a good example of that. Compared to what it was 40 or 50 years ago. Yeah, Constantine, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just talking about the South Africans. I think the South Africans that you met were probably the liberal type. I don't think they were the actual farmers that have now been invited by Russia, because Russia actually invited farmers. And I think the people that you met probably in Arizona or wherever, I don't think they were farmers, or were they? Or Boer farmers. Because I know several South Africans here in Moscow, and they're also pretty cocked and pretty liberal. Not all of
them.
Yeah,
you might be right.
Of them are farmers, you know.
We're getting close to the end of the show. I think before I wrap things up, Ashley, you said you wanted to make a clarification about something I said on our last show.
Oh, well, yeah, I was just talking about... On the last show, I mentioned that the predominance of white people in lots of different types of political spheres, ideologies, and you immediately went to talking about the Swipple stuff, and obviously I meant that as well, but I didn't just mean that. I meant that abstract philosophies just based on any kind of abstract principle, writing up manifestos and this kind of thing, just that kind of thing as a whole in general seems to be characteristic of whites more than any other group.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Ashley Messinger, Constantine von Hofmeister, Brandon Adamson for being on. It's been an excellent show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. Take care.
All right. Cheers.